equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettenauer, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. I've got a blog called Relocalizing Vermont. It's one of the many blogs at the Vermont Commons website, vtcommons.org/blog. And the audio from this show and Travin's shows on Tuesdays are posted at the Equal Time Radio website. That's equaltimeradio.com. And I usually try to get mine up by the end of the day on Tuesday. Today we have a great show coming up. I really enjoy talking to people who have different perspectives and they can bring it on the same subject. The theme today is how we can be better off without a lot of the technologies that keep us indoors and separated from each other. You know, I spend a lot of time here on Equal Time Radio Mondays talking with people who foresee a rapid reduction in oil availability, and sometimes we talk about what happened in 1973, 1974, when we actually saw a rapid reduction in oil availability. Saw long lines at gas stations, saw rationing, saw fights breaking out in lines, and other unpleasantness. And then there are people who see the end of the age of oil as offering possibilities for a more fulfilling life. We'll talk to two people today who hint at that in their work. Now, I want to make sure that I represent them correctly. Neither of my guests has written a book specifically about the end of the age of oil, but I think their books are pretty interesting in that context. Eric Brende, during his studies at MIT, went from one of the technology capitals of the world there in Cambridge to an old order Amish-like community where he and his wife joined them in a life without motors or electricity. In a lot of ways, he found the 19th century way of living more rewarding than that of the 20th century when that took place. He chronicled the experience in his book, Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. I love that title, Better Off. People are better off without it. Better off. Technology is better off. But before that, we're going to talk with Dr. Stephen Ilardi, an associate professor of psychology at the University of Kansas. He's written The Depression Cure, the 6-step program to beat depression without drugs. And in it, he urges patients to look to their evolutionary past to beat depression. In fact, he says the Amish automatically do a lot to ward off depression, and it shows. We'll also get the two guests in conversation with each other, which I really look forward to, and we'll take your phone calls. First, though, I want to follow up a little bit on a show from about a month ago. There's a special offer I want to make you aware of. At least it's not just to the Equal Time Radio listeners, but you can be among the first to know about it. A chance to be in the thick of discussions that could help set policy for our state on a range of issues. Last month, State Senator Ginny Lyons was on the show to talk about the ways that Burlington leads the nation in energy policy. She also mentioned an upcoming conference in Burlington, but it wasn't clear whether the general public was invited.
August 2nd through 5th, the Council for State Governments Eastern Region will be meeting in Burlington at the Hilton. And we will be looking at economic development. Certainly the current trend in the economy is one of concern to all legislators. But we're combining that with a look at energy as well as other areas.
Is this something that would be open to members of the general public or maybe select board members from Vermont who wanted to hear what was going on in other states?
You know, it's really for folks who are legislators, and I don't know what the rules are about attendees coming in from the community.
Well, I saw Ginny Lyons at Democracy Fest yesterday in Burlington. She told me that she'd called the national office, and members of the public are welcome to attend the conference for a special rate of $25 a day at the door. You might be able to pre-register for that, too, but she said you could pay at the door. And she asked me to tell Equal Time listeners about the possibility. Now, the full program for the conference is on the web. It's kind of an odd website, not easy to give over the air, but I put it on the Equal Time Radio website. So if you go to equaltimeradio.com, you'll find a link to the Council of State Governments Northeastern Regional Conference here in Burlington, August 2 through 5. That's equaltimeradio.com. And now on to our first guest. You know, growing our own food, hunting, and relearning other outdoor skills are ways to prepare for a life with a lot less oil, and they may be mentally healthier, too. Dr. Stephen Ilardi blames the country's epidemic of depression on modern technology and on our lifestyle. He's written The Depression Cure, the six-step program to beat depression without drugs. And we're going to talk about how that program works and the six ancient ways of living that it reclaims. Steve Ilardi is Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Kansas, and he's joining us on the phone from Kansas. Steve, welcome to Equal Time Radio.
Thanks so much, Carl. It's a pleasure to be back with you today.
And can you begin by helping us understand what we're talking about, what depression is?
Absolutely. Well, depression is probably the most tragically misunderstood term in the entire psychiatric world because, you know, the problem with depression is it's a word that's used in everyday conversation. People will basically use the term as a way of saying they feel sad. And so a lot of times when we clinicians use the term as a technical diagnosis, folks have, you know, extraordinary misunderstandings because when they hear someone who says, hey, I just came back from my doctor, I just came back from my psychologist, and they said I have depression, well, depression, as we clinicians use the term, it's a debilitating illness. It's something that profoundly affects brain function. It profoundly affects the way the body operates. It robs people of their energy, of their concentration, of their memory, of their sex drive, of their ability to experience pleasure. It robs them of their will to live in many situations, and it actually accounts for 1 million deaths worldwide every year due to depression-linked suicide because it entails such extraordinary pain that many people start to look to death in a desperate bid to escape. Now, when people use the word depression in everyday conversation, they're referring to something much less serious, right? They're just talking about, well, hey, I feel a little down, I feel a little blue. And in that sense, that type of depression is nothing to be concerned about. It's part of the human condition. But again, there's tragic misunderstanding because clinical depression is so much more serious.
What about when people hit a really hard setback in life? You lose a child, a spouse, a parent, lose their job, maybe several of those at once, and they go into a real funk. Is that clinical depression, or is that something different?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a very insightful question. There are some elements of symptomatic overlap. In other words, when we experience bereavement or intense grief due to the loss of a loved one or due to some other extraordinary traumatic setback in our life, it is normal. It's part of our evolutionary heritage, it seems, to experience intense sadness and temporarily, at least, to shut down somewhat. The difference, though, is that in cases of normal grieving and bereavement, people typically still find some way to continue to function as their family and friends rally around them. And also, they typically don't tend to turn their thought process in such a starkly negative direction that generalizes and universalizes. So in other words, well, here's a distinction that actually goes back a century among clinicians. In bereavement or grief, the person says, "This is terrible." In depression, the person says, "I am terrible." Does that make sense?
That's a big distinction.
It's a big distinction. And so when we're grieving, even though we're in agony and pain over the torment of our loss, we still find great comfort in our loved ones, in our family, in ritual, in beliefs. When a person's clinically depressed, they find comfort nowhere.
Sounds awful.
It is.
And I was astonished reading in your book, The Depression Cure, by the prevalence of depression in the U.S. and by how much it's increased in recent years.
It's extraordinary, Carl. It's now 1 in 4 Americans who will suffer from this debilitating illness. There's one other thing about it I forgot to mention, and that is we now know through modern neuroscience that over time, depressive illness actually is neurotoxic. In other words, it can damage the brain by shutting down the brain's production of a key growth hormone that's needed to keep neurons functioning well and maintained and healthy. And so when we say 1 out of 4 Americans will suffer from depressive illness, we're talking about a tragedy of epic proportions. It really should be blaring from the headlines of our papers. Depression is already the single leading cause of disability, work-related disability, in the U.S., and there's not even a close second. And the situation is only getting worse because the rates of depression have been going up radically for every successive generation going back for an entire century. And the best evidence we have suggests that the rate of depression has doubled over the past decade, despite the fact that use of antidepressant medications has also more than doubled. So the medications clearly are not representing the solution to this problem.
In fact, you're pretty unimpressed with the clinical trials showing what happens when people take antidepressant medications.
Well, yeah, I have to be careful on this point because I'm sure probably you and most of your listeners, and certainly I myself, have known people who have benefited from the medications. And so I want to be really clear that I'm not anti-medication per se. I'm grateful for the relief that they sometimes bring. But having put that caveat out there, what I will say is if we look at the data from the clinical trials, they're really pretty unimpressive. And what I mean by that is, first of all, the short-term success rate for antidepressants is abysmally low. The best study that was ever published came out about a year and a half ago. It was called the STAR-D trial. And you know what they found? Only 28% of depressed individuals who were put on typical antidepressant therapy, only 28% experienced complete remission over the course of the first 3 months. 28%. Fewer than one in two experienced any clinically significant relief at all in the short term. And it just gets worse because most patients who go on antidepressant medications will stop taking them within the first 2 to 3 months. And then even among those who get some benefit, whether it be complete remission or partial remission, at least half of those will become depressed again within the first year after they stop taking the medication. So the meds don't provide a lasting cure for all but a small, fortunate subset of the patients who try them.
We're talking with Steve Ilardi. He's the author of The Depression Cure, and he's from the University of Kansas. And you can join us with your phone calls if you want. The local number is 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. So thank you, Steve, for that overview of depression, and really its debilitating effects both on people, individuals, and society. Now, let's get to the heart of your fascinating work with the six-step program to beat depression without drugs. You got a clue from the Amish in this country and from Australian Aboriginals.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the remarkable thing to me is about 5 years ago, like many of my colleagues, I started kind of pounding my head against my office wall as I reflected on the fact that rates of depression just keep going up and up and up all over the industrialized developed world, and nobody has an answer. Nobody had any sort of coherent explanation for why or how this could be. And then I started looking at cross-national studies, data from the World Health Organization and others, and then I discovered a couple of very provocative findings that really helped all the pieces fall into place. The first was, as you mentioned, the North American Amish have been studied for their rates of mental illness. And the interesting thing is a lot of people just assume, oh, well, maybe the Amish are very secretive, or maybe they wouldn't really trust outsiders to come in and really honestly report. That is not at all the case. They were very, in epidemiologists who work with them said they were very forthcoming, very extraordinarily open, and they reported the prevalence of one fairly common mental illness, which is bipolar disorder, which is the most heavily genetic form of mental illness that we know of. Their rates of bipolar illness are about the same as that of the rest of the country, but their rates of depression, major depressive disorder, are about 10 times lower, 10 times lower than that of the rest of the country. So they're the only group that we know of in the U.S. that has escaped this burgeoning depressive epidemic. But then the other data point is if you look at modern-day Aboriginal groups, hunter-gatherer groups, the most famous that have been studied are the Kaluli people of Papua New Guinea, so this is the New Guinea Highlands, and Edward Schieffelin, an anthropologist, Western anthropologist, spent 10 years looking at rates of depressive illness among the Kaluli, who lead very difficult lives. They have a much lower life expectancy, high rates of infant mortality, high rates of death due to violence, high rates of parasitic infection, and yet they are virtually immune to depressive illness. Their rate of depression appears to be less than 0.1%. Absolutely extraordinary. What's the answer? The answer is everywhere we look across the globe, depressive illness appears to vary as a function of modernization, industrialization, and westernization. The answer is we were never designed for the pace of 21st century indoor, socially isolated, sleep-deprived, fast food-laden American life. We just were not designed for this at all.
And not even 20th century, as it turns out.
Not even 20th century. We just, you know, as a species, we've spent 99.9% of our existence as a human species in a hunter-gatherer context. And so we're really well adapted to the Pleistocene. We're also very well adapted to an agricultural, agrarian way of life, because over the past 12,000 years, most of our ancestors have been in that agrarian context, and there was some evolutionary selection pressure there, not a whole lot, but a little bit of tweaking of that Stone Age genome to accommodate an agrarian way of life. But there has been no evolutionary selection pressure over the past century and a half, two centuries. That's like 4 to 6, 8 generations. It's not enough time for there to be any selection pressure, and yet our environment has mutated so quickly, so radically, so sharply, that we now find ourselves with an extraordinary genome-environment mismatch. Genome, in other words, basically our genes are just not prepared to help us face modern life. And the result is extraordinary epidemics in so-called diseases of modernity. Diseases like obesity, like arthritis, like other inflammatory illness, and of course, like major depression.
So in your book, The Depression Cure, you go through this six-step program and give quite a few details on each step, plus how to put them together. And briefly now, Steve Ilardi, would you tell us what those six steps are?
Absolutely. And just as a preface, Carl, what I'll say is these are six things that we find hunter-gatherer groups doing in abundance. These are six things that we find the Amish doing in abundance. They're things that we can reclaim from an ancient way of life. So here we go. By the way, Carl, do you want me to elaborate on them or just list them and we'll go back through them later?
Why don't you list them and maybe, you know, give an explanatory sentence on each one?
Okay, great. So first, physical activity. Our bodies are engineered for continuous, vigorous activity. Hunter-gatherers get about 4 hours a day of intense physical activity. So do agrarian groups like the Amish. We have engineered almost all of the physical activity out of modern life. Exercise is potently antidepressant. Exercise changes the brain. It changes neurochemicals like dopamine, serotonin. So there's the first. Second, let's talk about nutrition, specifically omega-3 fats, which are key building blocks of brain tissue. They're key anti-inflammatory agents in the body. They are potently antidepressant, and they've all but disappeared from the modern American diet, largely in response to shifts in agriculture, basically industrializing the way in which we raise livestock has essentially led to the disappearance of omega-3s. Third thing is sunlight exposure. Our bodies are designed for extensive time outside. We have specialized receptors in the retina, in the back of the eye, that only respond to the brightness of sunlight, which is about 200 times brighter than indoor light. And those retinal receptors have a superhighway connection to centers in the brain, deep in primal areas of the brain that regulate our energy and our sleep and our mood and our hormones. When we're sunlight deprived, mood tends to plummet, we go out of balance, key risk factor for depression. Fourth, we have social connection. We're designed to live in communities. Hunter-gatherers live in groups of 50 to 100 people. They have extensive FaceTime with their loved ones all day long, and yet increasingly we're an isolated people. Carl, 50% of Americans in a recent extensive sociological survey, 50% of Americans reported that they don't have a single close friend, No one close enough to confide in to help them in a time of crisis, and this is a huge risk factor for the onset of depression. Fifth, rumination or brooding or dwelling. When people ruminate or dwell on their negative thoughts, that tends to amp up or ramp up the brain's stress response circuits. It's a very depressogenic activity, and people tend to ruminate when they're alone, when they're isolated, when they don't have engaging activity. Oftentimes we think of modern life as giving us all this great, wonderful leisure time, time to sit around in front of the TV, sit on the sofa. Well, guess what? When people have that sort of leisure time, they tend to brood and dwell on their negative thoughts, and this is horribly psychologically toxic. And then the last thing is sleep. Before Thomas Edison came along and gave us the indoor light bulb, the average American adult got over 9 hours sleep a night. Now, in the year 2009, the average American adult gets 3 hours less sleep a night.
Wow.
And it's taking a huge toll. We all know that sleep has a profound effect on our sense of well-being, on our mood, on our energy. And it's actually a time when brain circuits get recharged and re-energized. And, you know, as we walk around as a nation of sleep-deprived individuals, 90% or more are addicted to caffeine or some other stimulant. This is a huge risk factor for the onset of depression.
These sound like an ancient formula, but also, you know, mom's formula. Get plenty of exercise, play outside,
yeah.
Eat your vegetables, and go to bed early, and, you know, see your friends.
Yeah, and grandma might have even tried to give you some sort of cod liver oil supplement, right? Which would
right.
have been a rich source of omega-3 fats. Absolutely.
Right.
Well, isn't that interesting?
Mom was right.
And grandma knew best. And and you know, what's wonderful to me, and I think really a beautiful thing, is the fact that we now have modern neuroscience. You talk about something on the cutting edge of technology, these extraordinary, sophisticated neuroimaging devices that can give us real-time snapshots of brain function. And you know what they're telling us? They're telling us that experience changes the brain. So that just because we can affirm that depression involves chemical imbalance, we don't have to then automatically take the next step and say, oh, I have a chemical imbalance, therefore I need to take drugs. I must ingest chemicals. Because the fact of the matter is, experience changes the brain. So when grandma said, look, you need to spend more time outdoors getting fresh air and natural sunlight. Well, we now know that sunlight profoundly changes the brain. We know that spending time with our loved ones changes our brain. And all of these things push us in an antidepressant direction. And the wonderful thing is, each of these six elements that I've talked about has been studied rigorously by clinical scientists and shown to fight depression as effectively, if not more so, than the most powerful antidepressant medications that are available. And the wonderful thing is, they don't come with any debilitating side effects. They don't cause people to have sexual problems as many antidepressants do. They don't have a withdrawal syndrome. All of the side effects are beneficial.
There's no way for Big Pharma to make a money off of this that I can see. Are you wearing a bulletproof vest when you go outside?
Well, you know, I think it's safe to say that Big Pharma certainly has no vested interest in getting the word out to people that they can change their brain chemistry by changing their life. In fact, quite the opposite. Big Pharma has spent a whole lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, promoting the idea of chemical imbalance, trusting that people will automatically assume, oh, if I have chemical imbalance, I must swallow some chemicals. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. We can change our brain by changing our life.
Steve Ilardi, it's been great talking with you about your book, The Depression Cure. I want to keep you on the line now because you said that you got some of the insights that led you to put together this six-step program to beat depression without drugs from looking at the American Amish. In just a minute, we're going to talk with Eric Brende. He's the author of Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. He actually lived with an old order Amish-like community for a year and a half, and we'll hear from him what that was like and what the mental health was like in that community. We'll be back right after this. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettinger, your Monday host, and today we're having a fascinating combination of guests. We've been talking with Dr. Steven Ilardi. He is the author of The Depression Cure, the six-step program to beat depression without drugs. If you're interested in reading more about the book, well, you can go get the book at your local bookstore, but you can also go to his website, thedepressioncurebook.com. That's thedepressioncurebook.com. Now, this cure was inspired in part by the lack of depression, clinical depression, amongst Amish in this country. And now we're going to be joined by Eric Brende. He spent a year and a half living with a community that was very much like the old order Amish. And Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we want to get to the details of your experience living with this community without motors or electricity and how you got there in the final part of today's show. But we want to have a conversation between you and Steve Ilardi now. So to begin with, can you tell our listeners just enough about your life with the Minimites to help them understand a little bit of the experience that you bring to your observations and comments?
Sure. By the way, I called them Minimites in my book because I didn't want to reveal who they really were. That was part of my agreement with living with them and writing about them. They're actually very much akin to the Amish, and they include some actual Amish amongst them. But if I were to name them, I'd be violating my agreement. It's a very unusual group. I stumbled onto one of them when I was taking a bus to MIT, where I was a graduate student. And I got into a conversation with him by the side of the bus at a rest stop. And one thing led to another. The next thing I knew, the next summer, I was being allowed to visit their community. Then I set up a longer stay for me and my wife that turned out to be basically an extension of my work at MIT. I was in the Program for Science, Technology, and Society, taking a critical look at the role of labor-saving devices in our society. And my thesis is very similar to that of your guest, that labor gives meaning to our lives. And if we are surrounded by labor-saving devices, we've just deprived ourselves of something that is essential to our well-being and fulfillment, physical labor. So I went to live with them, with my wife, and had a wonderful year-long experience. It was really our honeymoon. We just got married 10 days before, and I'd say that was the happiest year and a half of my life. It was definitely not depressing. And everything that you listed, your guest listed, the sixfold cure, every single one of those points was extremely relevant to my experience, including, I noticed in the winter, the lack of sunlight. The one time when I sort of did get the doldrums was during the winter when there was very little sun, and there was a low eave on the southern side of our house that prevented the sunlight from getting in, and I think that was part of the problem.
And how about exercise in the winter?
Oh, well, yeah, there's less exercise in the winter, but you can still get exercise by doing winter chores as well. I mean, there's less of it, but you can still do it.
Did your social connections decrease during the winter?
Yeah, naturally, yeah. Because, of course, most of the work is in the warmer months in a farming community. And the thing that I would refine, I wouldn't say it's an error or anything wrong I'm sorry, what's our guest's name again?
Steve Ilardi.
Steve Ilardi. Dr. Ilardi's thesis. The one thing that I would sort of say to refine what he's saying is that I don't think it's so much that we don't have exercise or don't have access to exercise, nutrition, sunlight, social connections, and sleep in our society today. I think the bigger issue is more that they're not available in an integrated form. So we have to get them piecemeal. Yes, we can get exercise, but we have to go to a gym. Yes, we can get a social connection, but we have to schedule it like as quality time into our schedule and plan it out in advance.
Yeah, and Eric, actually, you know, I think you and I are really on the same page there. And as I explain in the book, you know, my thesis is simply, as you say, not that these things can't be available or aren't available to some. It's the fact that we have engineered so many of them out of the routine of our lives.
Exactly, yes.
That it actually takes quite a bit of proactive effort to reintegrate them. And that's really what the premise of the book is that we can be very clever and proactive about doing the work necessary to reclaim these healing elements from the past. But it does take some effort.
Now, Steve Ilardi, one of the things that Eric Brende talks about in his book is that the jobs that he's held that haven't involved physical labor in and of themselves, but he's commuted by bicycle to them, and that has gotten him the physical labor that helps him feel better. Do you advise your clients to sell their cars?
I have at times, but no. I say to them is, look, we need to be very clever
about how we can reclaim and reintroduce these healing habits back into our lives. And if that means selling a car, then so be it. But for some people, it simply means finding ways of integrating activity, in this case, physical activity, back into their routine. Does that make sense? So in other words, I mean, here's an interesting fact for you. Evolutionarily, we actually seem to be designed to avoid physical activity when it doesn't have a clear sense of purpose and meaning. So I really like what Eric is saying about the life of the Amish involves so much physical activity that has an immediate sense of meaning and purpose. When you take a lab rat, a laboratory rat, and try to get it to run on a piece of exercise equipment like a treadmill, it will actually squat down on its haunches in protest until the treadmill starts to wear the fur and skin right off of its backside.
Oh, no.
It will. It feels our pain. And when we look at a piece of exercise equipment, there are little circuits in the back of our brain that are basically screaming out to us, don't do it. Don't get up on that thing because you're not going anywhere. It doesn't have a purpose. It doesn't have meaning. And so for the person who's bold enough and brave enough to sell their car, well, now they have lots of need for physical activity just to get from one place to another. So it's a radical solution, but I think it's also a very elegant solution. But there are other solutions out there. I mean, just in the interest of full disclosure, I still have a car, and yet I manage typically to work in at least an hour of physical activity into my routine every day.
Hmm. And Eric Brendig, you're a trained musician, a pianist, fairly accomplished, it sounds like, and you use musical metaphors to describe some of the meaningful work and working together and social connections that you build up while doing that in this Amish-like community. Could you describe that?
Well, yeah, I'd say that one of the beautiful things about the kind of farm labor that these Amish yeomen still practice is that you can liken it to an almost symphonic experience, with the exercise of performing the role of the rhythm section, or the lower parts of the orchestra. It forms a kind of, and the musical term would be obbligato. It's a repetitive kind of a drum beat, kind of an accompaniment, and overlaid on top of that, you have the melody of conversation or bird song or idle banter or just enjoying nature. And it's a many-layered experience. And there's two things about that many-layered experience that make it so much superior to the fragmented kind of desperate attempt on our part today to recover that through exercise machines or quality time scheduled here and there. And the two things are, one, you're delivered so much more simultaneously, so it's more efficient. You're getting your exercise, your social life, your experience of the outdoors, your experience of sunlight, all at once. It's simultaneous, so it's much more efficient than doing it piecemeal. Secondly, and perhaps equally importantly, it's the experience is richer, it's fuller than the kind of diluted experience you get sitting in front of a television set or going to a gym where you're there just doing the exercise. There's very little social contact. So that combination just makes it very potent, and I'm sure that's why the Amish have one-tenth the depression. And I do mention that in my book, Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. Somewhere in there, I mentioned the study by Janice Egeland that pointed that out, that the Amish have one-tenth the rate of depression the rest of us do. And it comes up in a conversation when we're on the hay wagon. We're talking about depression itself, one of the many conversations I cite in the book. And by the way, can I digress 1 minute? One reason I almost didn't make it onto this show today, I was out practicing the depression cure with my children. We were working outside on this deck that I've been working on for 2 years, and we were having a great social experience. I was enjoying the sunlight, getting the exercise, chatting with my 13-year-old daughter who was helping me paint the deck, and The phone, which I had kept strapped to my belt, fell off from the second story and landed upside down in a pan of paint.
Oh, dear.
So sometimes it can be counterproductive if you're trying to get on talk radio shows to be out there doing the depression cure. But anyway.
We rely pretty heavily on technology in this show, I'm afraid. So Steve Velarde, I'm wondering, you know, as I think through the people I know, I would have a hard time saying who has clinical depression and who doesn't, or saying that I know many people who have clinical depression. Could someone like Eric Brende, living in this sort of community, what sort of observations could he make on the relative mental health of people around him versus in Boston without going through, you know, detailed clinical interviews?
So in other words, just you want to have a little heuristic, some rules of thumb for helping him think about, hey, were there folks that had depression?
Exactly.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I would say is a hallmark of depression is it tends to activate circuits in the brain that cause us to want to withdraw socially. They're the same circuits that activate when we're fighting an infectious illness. So in other words, when we have a bad case of the flu, we tend to pull away from everyone around us. And of course, this is an evolved adaptation to prevent us from spreading contagious illness. Mm. Well, those same circuits get engaged in depression, and people who would otherwise want to socialize, we find them pulling away, we see them shutting down, we see often sad mood, but sometimes people can put on a happy face, but it's just an uncharacteristic type of shutting down and withdrawal.
Hmm. And Eric Brende, your comments on that, any observations?
Well, I'd say that in the community where I was, there were actually two or three people who did have clinical depression.
Hmm.
And I knew that because I had some inside information. I lived with them long enough that, and I recognized it because of the way they talked. They had a certain way of shuffling their sounds that gave away the fact they were taking antidepressants.
Hmm.
But I think that the reason they had it was because it was genetic. I don't think it was environmentally caused.
Hmm.
So they still get depression, bipolar depression, at the same rate as the rest of the population.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, it can be rather confusing because bipolar illness, which only afflicts about 1 to 2% of Americans, unlike unipolar depression, which is the most common form, which afflicts about 25% of Americans, bipolar is heavily genetic. It is influenced by environmental factors. So in other words, it's a combination. It's a diathesis stress reaction. It's environment plus genetics. But it's absolutely true that the Amish do have a rate of bipolar illness that's about the same as the rest of the population, and it can involve a sort of shutting down that very much looks like clinical depression.
Hmm. Well, we're going to learn more about Eric Brende's year and a half with an Amish-like community in just a minute, and Steve Velarde, I want to thank you for your time talking about the depression cure, six-step program to beat depression without drugs. When we get this audio up on the EqualTimeRadio.com website, we'll have a link to your website. Do you have any final comments for us, Steve Velarde?
Well, I really just greatly appreciate what Eric's brought to this discussion. I think it's fascinating to hear about his insights, and the most valuable thing is just to hear what you said, that year of living the way our bodies and our brains are designed to live, that was the happiest year of your life, the most fulfilling. And I think it really just validates the entire premise that we weren't designed for modern life, and that the best we can do to reclaim those protective factors, that will, in fact, protect us from depressive illness and will also help fight any depression that we may be suffering from in the moment. So thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Yep. Thank you, Steve. And we'll be back with more conversation about Eric Brende's year and a half living amongst the Amish-like community he was with and his reflections on it in just a minute. I'm Carl Etnair. You're listening to Equal Time. We'll be right back.